If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue. Cause we're all somewhere in the middle. We're all just looking for love to change the world. And we're all here in it together. We're one step closer to breaking down the walls.
Thanks for tuning in,
and welcome to the September 7th, 2020 Labor Day edition of IMRU Radio Magazine, the world's longest-running lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender radio show, out front and out loud since 1974. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Tonight, we take a look at a documentary about the murder of a transgender woman by a U.S. sailor in the Philippines. We visit Rising Up with Sonali for a book discussion about Oscar Wilde's anarchist philosophy, an encore, a gay Tino report, with iconic labor leader Dolores Huerta, to celebrate Labor Day and the upcoming National Hispanic American Heritage Month. First, take it away, Sonali.
Oscar Wilde, the famous, celebrated, and legendary writer and playwright known for such books as The Importance of Being Earnest and The Picture of Dorian Gray, was, by today's standards, Antifa. The philosophical depth and political radicalism of Oscar Wilde's ideas were in line with anarchist ideals and are hugely relevant to today's culture wars. My guest is Christian Williams. He is the author of several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Between the Bullet and the Lie, Essays on Orwell. His latest book, with a foreword from the well-known comic writer Alan Moore, is called Resist Everything Except Temptation, The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde. Welcome to the program, Christian.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So for those who are only sort of vaguely familiar with Oscar Wilde, I imagine that they think of him as a rebel, this gay icon who flaunted the norms of the day, who pushed aside puritanical ideals, but he had politics, he had political views. How would you describe what those views are? And, you know, what? How did he express them outside of his most famous works of fiction?
The best way of understanding Wilde's politics is in terms of the anarchism of his day. And I position his writing, and in particular his political writing, within the anarchist tradition, looking at both the anarchist influences in his thinking and then the influence that his work had in later anarchist thought. And then I begin with an examination of his most famous political work, that being The Soul of Man Under Socialism, and then work outward into things that are not so obviously political, including things like The Picture of Dorian Gray and even The Importance of Being Earnest, which on its face is just a long exercise in silliness, but I think that it's a very serious kind of silliness.
So we should even step back, because this is an issue that is quite relevant today. I mentioned the word Antifa. It's a very loaded word. Of course, it just means anti-fascist, but it's lined with the, you know, the sort of black-clad anarchist types that mainstream media, corporate media, conservatives very much like to symbolize anarchism or personify anarchism as. How do you just explain anarchism to an American audience, to a lay audience today?
I believe that anarchism begins with the precept that decisions should be made by the people most affected by them. And so that means that society should be structured in a relatively non-hierarchical manner that maximizes individual freedom and is based on equality in social relationships. So in practice, what that would mean is, rather than workplaces being organized according to as these kinds of dictatorships where the person who owns the place determines everything, Instead, the workplaces should be collectively managed by the people who work there, and in fact, collectively owned by the people who work there. Similarly, rather than neighborhood life being governed by anonymous bureaucrats in some planning office, people who live in the neighborhood should make decisions about how things in their neighborhood are set up. In principle, I think it's a very simple doctrine, but working out in practice exactly how that means that power gets shared and power gets exercised can be pretty complicated.
Within that definition, how does Oscar Wilde fit?
Well, in his most famous political work, The Soul of Man Under Socialism, he makes this argument that...
The Soul of Man Under Socialism. This was an essay that he wrote that's not as well known, of course, as his works of fiction.
He argues that the purpose of socialism is that it will make individualism possible, that it will make it available for people to live their most full lives. They'll be freed from the burden of having to scramble in the capitalist economy and really sort of work for other people. He makes it clear in that essay that what he has in mind is not any sort of authoritarian kind of socialism, but instead a sort of voluntary arrangement between everybody in the community in which they share resources and make decisions together. So although he doesn't use the word anarchism in that essay, it's clear that what he has in mind is much more in line with what anarchists at the time, like, for example, Wilde's friend Peter Kropotkin, were writing about than it would be for the sort of authoritarian and bureaucratic version of socialism that became dominant in the 20th century.
So he was born into aristocracy, right? Which one might, you know, imagine could be held against him. But how did he square the circumstances of his own birth with his politics?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that he ever felt like he needed to apologize for his background, but that was not unimportant either in his development, in particular because though he was part of the aristocracy, he was also part of the Irish aristocracy. And at a time when the Irish independence movement was at a particularly militant clip, and in fact his mother was very involved in the Young Ireland movement a generation earlier, so he developed out of the milieu of Irish nationalism. And I argue in the book, from that principle of feeling like Ireland shouldn't be ruled by England, eventually evolved his thinking to the point that no one should be ruled by anyone. The principle of autonomy that informed his early nationalism eventually became universalized as a principle of anarchism.
When we talk about the fiction work in particular, I want to pick up on what you were saying earlier with some of his fiction works around, especially the importance of being earnest. How do his philosophies manifest themselves? What were some of the ways in which he saw the social order needing to change?
Well, in the fiction and in the plays in particular, they're mostly remembered as these sorts of just aesthetic exercises. And I think that they seem to be more interested in sort of the free play of language and the beauty of the presentation rather than questions of character or plot or message or anything like that. In fact, he would argue in his critical work that the aesthetic should predominate and that art should be something other than just a way of delivering sermons. But there's a kind of politics even implicit in that aesthetic approach, in that it eschews the sort of utilitarian and the sort of practical aspects of the capitalist notion that everything to be justified has to be useful. Instead, it implies that there are things that can be good without serving some greater purpose, that just the mere beauty of it is, in fact, enough.
Which is that very said, much sort of in opposed to how our economies are organized today, the consumerism of the American economy, viewing people as resources, right?
Yes, it's in total contradiction to the market thinking, and also belatedly in opposition to the sort of Victorian moralism that was predominant at the time, the idea that any work of art, any sort of piece of culture, that its ultimate purpose should be to instill moral values in the reader. Wilde was way more interested in the pleasure it could give to the reader rather than an effort to like reform his audience's character. All that said, there are also, if you pay attention to the content of the society plays and if you pay attention to the content of the fiction, there often is a overt political element. I mean, many of the society plays turn on questions of sexual propriety. They turn on questions of social status and the way that people compromise themselves in order to gain status, and even the importance of being earnest, which, you know, on its surface just seems like this kind of volley of witticisms. The plot turns on this question of having a good name, and built into that are questions of the legitimacy of children, the way that status gets relayed from one generation to the next, and in particular also questions of gender and relations between the sexes. All of that is easy to miss because it's so funny, but the reason it's so funny is because he's subverting the norms of his time. The fact that it remains funny more than 100 years later is pretty remarkable.
How did he view the use of violence as a political tool? Today, anarchism is unfortunately deeply linked to violence by its detractors.
Yeah, this is a complicated question, and he had different thoughts on it in different moments. On the one hand, he said that, I mean, one of the few occasions in which he used the term anarchism, he said that we are all socialists nowadays, but so I must be something more. I think perhaps I'm an anarchist. And then he immediately went on to say, but of course the dynamite policy is absurd. The dynamite policy being a sort of shorthand for what was called propaganda by the deed, which was the idea that a program of terrorism and assassinations could show the vulnerability of the government and inspire masses to rise up. That it never worked out that way. So in terms of success, he was definitely right that it was absurd. That said, he had a great deal of sympathy for people who engaged in those sorts of tactics. And he also had a great deal of sympathy for, you know, sort of riotous street demonstrations and that sort of thing. And he explicitly defends them in this whole manner of socialism.
And was there a debate at that time around property destruction versus harming humans like there is today?
To the degree that there was a debate, it was sort of a nascent version of the same thing that we have. I mean, the people who rule society were very inclined to see the destruction of their property as being equivalent to acts of warfare. And in fact, there was little distinction made in the eyes of the authorities between what we would consider just sort of a normal demonstration and what they would consider a riot. And if you read the literature of the time, it's very common to see normal sort of strike activity of just workers walking out of the job described by the police as a riot. So the standard of order was very high, and anything that disrupted that was sort of automatically put in this category of sort of riotous unrest.
So when we examine Oscar Wilde's writings today, do you think it's apparent to contemporary readers that he had these political sensibilities built into especially some of his famous fiction writings? Or is this something that, someone paying attention to our so-called culture wars today would be able to discern?
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely there. And I argue in the book that if we pay attention to, if we take what he writes seriously, the politics become very evident. On the other hand, I did write a 200-page book sort of excavating what the politics are. So I think there's a little bit of work to be done in terms of bringing it to the forefront. He wasn't someone like Dickens. He wasn't like a message writer. But nevertheless, the politics definitely find their way in the work and I think animate a lot of what makes the work interesting. On the other hand, some of what he does is very subtle and depends on some understanding of the context in which he was writing. So if you're familiar with the debates and anxieties that were characterizing Victorian society, at the time, his politics would have been much clearer. And in fact, he was often attacked for them.
Right. So the way in which Oscar Wilde is viewed today is very different from the way in which he was viewed by his contemporary peers, which is, of course, often the case for people with radical politics. So you think of not to compare Wilde to, say, Dr. King, but just as an example, we see Dr. Martin Luther King, who was much more radical during his time and vilified by his critics, today is seen in a much more romanticized light. And we certainly have that with a lot of other folks who have political leanings that are quite strong, and those political leanings either get pushed to the back or are just not seen as that radical years after their deaths. What about Oscar Wilde's sexuality and sexual orientation? How did that inform his politics? And he was certainly, very open about not wanting to live by the norms of Victorian society.
Yeah, I think finding himself as an outsider in terms of his sexuality did a lot to both muster his sympathy with other sorts of outsiders and also informed his attack on the Victorian moralism, on the sexual politics of the time. Interestingly, the aestheticism that we were talking about earlier, and that idea that beauty is its own justification, it doesn't have to be marketable, it doesn't have to be useful, was in the milieu in which he was operating also very tied up with these questions of sexuality. And the sort of Oxford aesthetes from which he came were more than usually sort of infused with a homosexual tendency. His sexuality played a very complicated role in his life overall, but it definitely did a lot to force his thinking outside of conventional frameworks. And I think did definitely inspire a lot of his political trajectory.
And so when we look at the relevance of Oscar Wilde today, as you see the political situation around us, the rebellion on the streets of the United States, the rise of fascism in the U.S., how would you characterize the relevance of Oscar Wilde's writings? Do you see them as having not just relevance, but even particularly an educational value or a source of inspiration?
Inspiration, for sure. And I think that as much time as separates our moment from the moment that he was writing, it's strange and sad how much the Victorian mindset has continued even a century later and even in the United States. And so I think Wilde provides a kind of antidote to a lot of our implicit moralism. I think his view about the beauty of life and beauty being a value in itself can help us to correct for the kind of market thinking and the utilitarianism that often ends up dictating so much of our lives. And I think also it helps to look back and for us to remember that socialism or anarchism or whatever it is we want to call it used to be about this idea that life could be beautiful and free, and that it was about something more than sort of the petty factional fights and the street fighting and, the sort of, it's easy, I think, to get lost in the grit of the day-to-day and forget the vision of the better world that we're looking for.
It's an idealism.
And I think, just remember that. Yes, exactly.
And that sort of aspirational aspect of socialism seems to be in a bit of a revival or enjoying a bit of a revival today.
I sure hope so.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Christian, for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Christian Williams. He's the author of several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Between the Bullet and the Lie, Essays on Orwell. His latest book, with a foreword from the well-known comic writer Alan Moore, is called Resist Everything Except Temptation, The Anarchist Philosophy of Oscar Wilde. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingup@sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
And as Oscar Wilde once said, be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Three pivotal moments in history coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. In President Obama's 2013 inaugural speech, he included three legendary locations in civil rights history: Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall. Seneca Falls, New York, was the site of the first women's rights convention organized by women in the Western world. Taking place on July 19th and 20th, 1848, it is seen as the beginning of the push for women's suffrage in the United States. On March 7th, 1965, in Selma, Alabama, about 200 Alabama state troopers clashed with 525 civil rights demonstrators, marking the peak of the American civil rights movement. That event became known as Bloody Sunday. And just after midnight on June 28th, 1969, the gay community fought back against police during a raid at the Stonewall Inn in New York City's Greenwich Village, thus marking the birth of the gay liberation movement. Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Bob Ulrich.
Hi, I'm David Sedaris, advising you to listen to the longest-running homosexual radio program in Southern California. I am. Are you?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray, and you're listening to I Am, Are You? Radio. In these shut-in times, streaming queer films online is essential for your sanity and education. Tonight, that's Call Her Ganda, a 2018 documentary that explores the murder of a transgender woman in the Philippines. While the facts were relatively straightforward, the aftermath soon became maddeningly complicated, and last week was made even more so. Steve Pride reports.
A United States Marine was convicted on Tuesday in the Philippines of killing Jennifer Laud after he discovered she was a transgender woman in a hotel while he was on a break in the military. Lance Corporal Joseph Scott Pemberton was convicted of homicide by strangling Laud and then dunking her head into a toilet bowl in the hotel after meeting at a disco in October 2014. The 20-year-old was charged with murder, but the court convicted him of homicide.
Jennifer Laude was 26 at the time of her murder, a time when life should begin, not end. Call Her Ganda is an important documentary from P.J. Ravel about her life and death that opens September 28th in Los Angeles.
My name is P.J. Ravel, and I am the director and producer of the feature documentary Call Her Ganda. It's about Jennifer Laude, who is a trans woman that was brutally murdered in the Philippines by a U.S. Marine. Our film centers around several women who are fighting under her name, trying to bring the Marine to trial.
And what attracted you to this project?
A lot of things brought me to this project. Basically, what happened was I'm Filipino-American, born and raised in the United States. Parents are from the Philippines, and I've always been wanting to find a way for me to combine all of my interests as a filmmaker and also just my interest of wanting to know more about my parents' homeland. So in fall of 2014, I was fortunate enough to be invited to go to Manila to screen two of my previous documentaries. And when I was there, it was shortly after the crime had been committed. So it was definitely in all the news. It was going through social media feeds. I was somewhat aware of it, but I was still following it from a more pedestrian distance. But while I was in Manila, I ended up on a panel for LGBT rights alongside attorney Virginia Suarez, who actually is one of the prosecuting attorneys representing the Laude family. On that panel, I learned a lot more about the story of Jennifer Laude. I was just really moved and inspired by Virgie herself, and she showed a clip of Nanay, which is in Tagalog means mother, so the mother of Jennifer Laude. And when I saw that clip, I was just blown away with how passionate and kind of like a very raw passion that Jennifer's mother held, which was undeniable how much she loved her daughter and how much she was grieving, that I thought, okay, well, this is such an important story. This needs to be told. And coincidentally enough, while I was on the panel, one of the audience members asked a question, commented, and then they said, oh, I think you, P.J. Ravel, should make a documentary about what's happening right now with Jennifer Laude. And I said, oh my God, yes, definitely someone needs to be doing this right now because it's so important and it's happening right now. And I said, but I don't know if it should be me. Maybe it should be someone on the ground who's already here. I don't live here. I'm coming from the United States. I don't want to be imposing my point of view as an outsider. But what was interesting was part of the panel was for this film festival, which was Pink Film Festival, which took place in Quezon City. It was an LGBTQ film festival. So a lot of people in the audience had seen my previous films, including Virginia Suarez, the attorney. So I think they kind of understood the kind of work that I made and thought maybe I should be doing this. And I thought about it, and I have to really give my partner a lot of credit because he was with me when this all was happening. And I remember afterwards, we all decided to go to lunch. And as I was walking to the restaurant, I was like, wow, God, maybe I should do this now that it's all very fresh, like within the last like hour of my brain, and it feels right, but I'm so scared to do this and I'm intimidated and I don't know if I should be the person to do this. And then when I got to the restaurant and I sat down and I spoke with Virgie and several of the trans activists who were there at the panel and on the panel, it became clear to me that they thought I would actually be a good person to do this as well, because since I am Filipino American, it says a lot for someone coming from the United States to be able to capture this story and present it to the rest of the world. And also, I started embracing the fact that I would have a unique perspective. As I mentioned, you know, born and raised in the United States, but I knew very little about the Philippines. I went through the public school system and, you know, I was taught very specific things, that the Philippines was a former colony. They were liberated from Spain by the United States, giving me these ideas of the United States being some kind of saviors, and that they were handed a democracy through the United States. And I never really knew more than that. So then when this came about, I thought to myself, okay, well, this will be good because I'm coming from the perspective of an American who knows very little, and I know that I know very little, so I'm going to have to learn a lot, and I'm going to have to investigate a lot. But I'm also coming from the point of view as a Filipino-American, so I understand Filipino culture to an extent just because I've lived in it through my family and through my extended relatives. So I thought, okay, this is my opportunity to have all my worlds combined here as a filmmaker, as a queer person, as a Filipino-American. So after the lunch was over, I said, okay, I'm heavily going to consider doing this. And I said, if I come back, will you let me start filming? And all of them said yes. And I said, okay. I said, the only thing that I need to know in order for me to start this is I need to make sure that the family is on board, because I had not met them yet. So Virgie, the lawyer, was awesome. And she showed the family some of my work, told them what I was interested in doing. And then I met them. And as soon as I met them, they were on board 100%. And that's when I just knew, okay, this was meant to be. It just kind of all came together very quickly. And, you know, when you're making a nonfiction piece, it's so much about access. Are you going to be able to let the subjects tell their stories? And so as soon as I knew that I had the permission from the family to do it, it was on. Jennifer has become a very political symbol. A lot of people didn't know her. They feel like they know her now just because they know who she is and they know what happened to her. But realistically, not many people actually know her. And when you get to know her actual backstory and who she was, and I mean, you very much just realize she was just, and I don't mean this in any disrespect, like, you know, just one of the many trans individuals just surviving in the Philippines in terms of working, sending money home to the family. And, you know, that's a very Filipino cultural thing, is usually children will make money and send money to their families if the families need the financial support. So she was a breadwinner. She was heavily loved by her family. She was incredibly kind and generous. And you could tell by, you know, in the film, I shoot several scenes with some of her friends, and even all of her friends say, you know, she was very intelligent, she was very sophisticated, she was very generous, perhaps even like a mentor figure for some of them. And so that was really amazing to know. But it also makes it just incredibly sad that someone that could be that inspirational for certain people was brutally killed. And just like anyone else, she had dreams of where she wanted to go and how she wanted to get there. Those were all, unfortunately, cut short. In terms of the Philippines itself, it's kind of strange to say, but I'm like really proud to be Filipino, because I think the Philippines is such a queer-friendly culture. And I'm sure some people will disagree with me, but from my perspective, just the presence of LGBT people is undeniable. And again, we're living in these strange times where someone like Jennifer Laude is being subject to violence, but at the same time, the Philippines elected their first trans congressperson. So that's amazing. And things I did not realize, and it's just kind of mind-blowing to me that I never thought about it this way, that the presence of maybe gender variant or queer individuals, or particularly what we would label now as trans individuals, have always existed in the history of the Philippines, similar to many other cultures that we see, indigenous cultures, right? In indigenous cultures, you usually have some kind of community leader, a shaman, someone who is highly respected. And the concept of someone who can tap into understanding the gender spectrum is highly respected. And of course, that all goes away with the Catholic Church and organized religion and people trying to wipe out that kind of structure. And that certainly is what had happened in the Philippines. So that was something I never knew. But I think this kind of summed it all up for me, having been born and raised in the United States, and as I mentioned, you know, knowing very little, is that the most amount of Filipinos ever killed on Philippine soil was at the hands of Americans. I never knew this. So after the Philippines is handed over from Spain to the United States, and technically the Philippines was purchased for, I forget how many millions of dollars, after the Spanish-American War, the Philippines fought back. So there was a Filipino-American War, right? A Philippine-American War. And I never really knew much about that. And it was very devastating to find out the American brutality that took place. And the reason it was so significant for me to learn this and look into this history was because it's clear to me that what happened to Jennifer Laude is an extension and continuation of that.
This has been a conversation with P.J. Raval about his documentary Call Her Ganda. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Last week, Lance Corporal Joseph Scott Pemberton was ordered released from prison less than 6 years into his sentence. Call Her Ganda is streaming on Amazon Prime. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Jazz saxophonist Peggy Gilbert, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. A superb musician and a tireless advocate for female musicians, Peggy Gilbert was also the leader of a number of popular all-women bands. Born in 1905, she played piano and violin by age 7. As a teenager, she picked up a saxophone for the first time and felt liberated. In the late 1930s, Gilbert wrote an article for Downbeat magazine, railing against the discrimination faced by female performers. It was printed with a degrading title, How Can You Blow a Horn with a Brassiere? Nevertheless, female musicians all over the U.S. showered her with gratitude. Gilbert's last band, the Dixie Bells, performed on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in 1981. Living to age 102, Gilbert was survived by Kay Boley, her partner for 6 decades. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Will Armstrong.
Hi, I'm Chaz Bono, and you're listening to IMRU Radio Magazine, out loud and proud since 1974.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray, and you're listening to IMRU Radio. Happy Labor Day, and in honor of workers everywhere, we encore Dan Guerrero's conversation with one of our most iconic labor leaders.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Gaytino Report, voices from the Latino LGBTQ community. I'm Dan Guerrero, or if you can roll your R's, Guerrero. And welcome to my very special guest, an American hero, my personal hero. A woman on a lifelong journey as a community organizer and social justice activist. Dolores Huerta has been an iconic civil rights leader for more than 50 years and still going strong. Most know she co-founded with Cesar Chavez the United Farm Workers Union. Some may not know Dolores has long been a champion for the LGBTQ community. A community that supported Dolores and Cesar in the earliest and most dangerous days of the UFW. Welcome, Dolores. Thank you so much for being on the Gaytino Report.
Oh, I love it.
Did we ever think we'd see a day when we have a radio show called the Gaytino?
Well, I'm sure that on this station it's definitely possible.
It is possible. I'm very happy to be doing this show and to be putting the spotlight on the Latino
LGBTQ community. Now, we've been friends for a long time, I'm very proud to say, and we've talked about many, many things, but it was only recently that we started to talk about the LGBTQ issue in our community, and that came about because of that story Luis Valdez told me about the People's Bar. Do you remember the People's Bar?
Oh, of course.
The LGBT community was very much supportive of you and Cesar back when you first were starting the UFW, and in those most dangerous days, they would march right alongside you.
We actually had a special button designed for our support LGBT community, and it was the farmworker eagle with the pink triangle. And actually, when we were on the boycott in 1968, many of our staff members were involved in the big marches that they had in the Stonewall marches back there in New York City. And then over the years, we always participated in the marches, gay pride marches here in West Hollywood and also in San Francisco. And it was wonderful because it would be great to see all the farm workers coming down with their flags. And I remember one farm worker saying to me in Spanish, "Ay, señora Huerta, esta gente nos quiere mucho." In English, he said, "Huerta," he said, "these people really love us." And I said, "Yes, they do, and they're very supportive of us." And so the farm workers just marched with so much pride in the gay pride march. So it was just wonderful to see that.
But getting back to the People's Bar, I was so amazed by that story. According to Luis, it was a bar owned by a lesbian woman, I believe Mocha. And after the marches and rallies and all that, the campesinos and you and Cesar would all go back and there'd be the gay community there hanging out at a lesbian bar. I think that's a movie scene.
Well, it's more than that. Mocha was actually Caesar's and Helen Chavez Caesar's wife, their comadre, because she baptized Caesar's oldest son, Fernando Chavez. And we had actually many of the strikers, we had a large component of gays that were part of the farmworker movement. Many of them worked at the DiGiorgio Ranch, which is one of the big companies that we were striking at that time. In fact, they were the object of one of our big boycotts that we had.
I know with the immigration issue, so I don't even know what to say, such a hot button issue. And for LGBT undocumented men and women, that's an additional challenge. I mean, it's a whole other ball game for them when you're undocumented.
Yeah, and it's really bad because we have many of our LGBT community who have their partners or the people that they have married who are undocumented, and they have a kind of a really, really big problem in terms of being able to fix their papers so that they can come over and join their spouses. So it is a very, very big issue, a very painful one.
Painful, yes, that's the right word. And also in terms of health, because if they're undocumented, they're afraid to go get tested for AIDS, and it's a domino effect in so many areas for the undocumented gay man or woman.
Well, I think in terms of testing, like we participate in that. One of my son-in-law's, Camilla's husband, he has, but what we have done when we do the testing is we actually take it out to the street. This is what we do in Kern County. We just don't wait for people to come to us. And we have a very active program there every single year to talk about the testing and do a lot of publicity
around
it.
Your foundation?
Yes. And we partner with other organizations to make this happen. But we don't wait for people to come to us. We go out there and look for them.
Can we talk about Juanita?
Yes, we can.
Well, I love Juanita. She's a pistol, that lady.
Oh, she sure is.
Your daughter, Juanita Chavez. Did she come out to you early, or how did that all come about?
I think after she graduated from San Francisco State College, then she let everybody know that she had a partner. So she lived with her partner for a few years. Her partner eventually transitioned and became a man.
She's very active, and she calls herself an out and proud member of the LGBTQ community. She was a teacher for a good many years. And she co-founded the first Gay Straight Alliance at Mission High School, where she went. Was that in Bakersfield?
Where was that? Was in San Francisco, right there in the Mission.
Oh, in the Mission District.
Yeah, she lived in San Francisco when she graduated from San Francisco State. Her first teaching job was at Mission High School. And she did more than that. She also created a clinic there and provided counseling services for the LGBT youth that were there at Mission High School.
She's currently the communications and media coordinator for the Dolores Huerta Foundation.
Yes.
This is Dan Guerrero with the Gaytino Report, and I'm talking to my very special guest, Dolores Huerta.
It's like you're going to go on forever doing this. It's such a marvel to see, and how you embrace so many of these, I don't know, I hate to call them causes, but I don't know what else to call
them,
and how they intersect each other.
Right. Well, it's a human rights agenda, you know.
Yes.
It's about human rights.
Yes, that's the basic, that's the bottom line.
What it's all about. And I was very fortunate, you know, I knew Harvey Milk. We campaigned for him when he ran for the Board of Supervisors. He was a very good friend of Caesar's and a good friend of Richard Chavez, Juanita's dad. So it's always been a very, very strong connection. People sometimes ask me, where did this evolve from? I said, well, I don't know. It's always been there. I can't ever remember a time when I remember going to Mexico when I was a teenager. I was 17 years old. And it was really interesting there because there were some gay waiters in this restaurant. And my stepfather was from Mexico City. And he said in Spanish, estos son los Luisitos. He said, those are, they call them Luis. And I said, what is that? What is that? He said, these are gay men. And he said, everybody has to protect them to make sure they're not harmed. And I thought, oh, that's such a beautiful sentiment. My stepfather was born in Mexico City, grew up in Mexico City. He was kind of from the middle class. And it's interesting, and then we saw how that changed later on. I really don't know the history there. I guess somebody from Mexico could say that. It may have been when, and I don't know when Fox became president or wherever, when it kind of reconnected with the Catholic Church again. So I don't know, but something happened there from the time I was 17. And of course, later on, we saw a lot of discrimination in Mexico. But it's interesting too that the Oaxacans, you know, they have a very different take on gender. There's a third gender, and the third gender are people that are very sacred, actually. And they have a wonderful celebration here in Los Angeles. I think it's called Los Mochis. And people dress up like in the Tijuana, which is part of the Tijuanas, these beautiful, beautiful costumes where they have the huge lace bonnets and these beautiful embroidered costumes with these huge embroidered skirts. And they have a beautiful celebration here in Los Angeles. And they every year they elect a queen. And it is a person from the third gender that is the queen. It's a beautiful celebration. I wasn't able to go this last year, but the year before last, and you had the Mexican consulate was there, and all of the local city officials were there. I think that there's a movie about this, and maybe we can have some of the folks that organize this beautiful
yes,
event.
Yes, I would love. I never knew event. About this.
Yeah, well, in Oaxaca, it happens every year. But now in Los Angeles, they've been doing it for a few years.
Well, it sounds like the Native Americans here in what is now the United States, because they also revered, they were called Two Spirits.
Right.
And they revered
exactly.
them. And it was like they were special,
exactly.
you know, because they understood the two uh-huh. worlds. Wow. Well, in Mexico City, going back a little bit, now, of course, gay marriage has been legal there for a good many years, and their gay pride. It's no longer the F, it's now Ciudad de Mexico, right? It's huge. They have a huge gay pride celebration there. So it has evolved there, which is fascinating to me, you know. We're getting some external noises because we are at the Catalina Bar and Grill, where Dolores Huerta has just been honored by KPFK, and for good reason. You've spoken very highly of KPFK, how it was the only voice in the early days of the movement.
Yes, absolutely. And this is such an incredible, incredible radio station. And what I love is when we think of the many years now that this has been celebrated, this organization. I remember when it was first started, because I am, as you know, 87 years old now. So I was just lucky to be alive when so many of these great things were just beginning, like the radio station. And knew some of the first pioneers that started the radio station. I was very lucky to know some of them. And to know this, it's still here.
And you are too.
And yes, I'm lucky to be here, but the people are still supporting KPFK and KPFA.
You know who personifies the whole issue of undocumented people who are of the LGBT community is Jose Antonio Vargas. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of people know about him. He was born in the Philippines, mm-hmm. and it wasn't until he was about 16 that he found out he was undocumented, mm-hmm. and he's a gay man. Mm-hmm. And I guess he's got a book coming out, but he personifies that whole issue.
Yeah, and Jose has been, as you know, very active all over the United States. He travels a lot, and he has an organization called Define America. And his organization tends to try to educate people on issues of the gay and lesbian transgender community, but also very, very active just in terms of the Dreamers.
Have you worked together? Have you
Yes,
met?
We have. Yeah, Jose, we have been working together. But in fact, this last year, he was very active on helping us out with the film also, the film Dolores that was produced by Carlos Santana.
Your documentary.
Yes, the documentary.
Your documentary was fantastic. The film, Rosario Dawson playing you, I don't think so. But the documentary, I've seen it twice. It's incredible. How did you feel about it?
I was really happy that they found so much footage that I had never seen. And they touched on the issues, of course, of sexism, discrimination against women, the farm workers being victorious over Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, and Ronald Reagan. I want to just say a word about Ronald Reagan. Maybe some of our listeners are going to say, well, Ronald Reagan brought us amnesty. Uh-uh, that didn't happen. He signed the law, but the ones who did the work on that amnesty bill was Ted Kennedy, Schumer, who is now in the Senate. He was in the head of the Judiciary Committee, Howard Berman here in California, Peter Rodino. They were the main people. And myself, I'm going to include myself, because one of the things that we're trying to do now is make, as women, get credit for the work that we do, right? And I worked on the amnesty bill for months in Washington, D.C. to make sure that it passed. And so just remember, Reagan is not all that great. But the film, I think, is really great because it also touches on the issues of police brutality. It touches on ethnic studies, which we know in Arizona. And you and I were marching there in Arizona when they were doing all of that discrimination against the undocumented people, and also taking ethnic studies out of the schools, out of the high schools. As you may know, the state Supreme Court has now ruled that they have to teach ethnic studies. So they lost that law that they passed.
I did love that film so much, but I loved hearing from your children. Well, they're not children anymore, mm-hmm. but they're still your children, your babies, mm-hmm. right? It mm-hmm. was Juanita spoke, and I think Ricky. Mm-hmm. And it humanized you because mm-hmm. everyone knows you as the iconic figure that you are. Mm-hmm. But you're a lady with family, mm-hmm. and it was beautiful to see that side.
Mm-hmm. And Camila, who's the executive director of my foundation, she's the one that does all the work while I'm running around the country, following the film around and doing speaking engagements.
Your energy I remember one time we were at some event, and then I called you the next morning to, I don't know what, and you said, oh, I'm in Cleveland, and I'm going to speak in a minute. I'm thinking, Cleveland? We were in L.A. at 11 o'clock last night, and you were, I don't know how you do it. I honestly don't.
Well, we try to cover as much as we can because we want to get the message out there about the Dreamers. We want to get the message out about, we want people to be sure and vote and go out and knock on doors and phone bank and get themselves elected. We're urging people, yes, run for the school board, run for the city council. We've got to get progressive people to take over the power. And of course, as we're talking about the issues of LGBT community, these are some of the things that we have to really work hard on, okay, so we can end the homophobia in our community and in our society. And I think we're on the way there. We're not there yet, but we know we have to get everybody involved.
I mean, it's important to celebrate how far we've come, because we have. Yes. We have. And yet the road ahead is very long and very treacherous. Mm-hmm. And we are currently in a backstep, as mm-hmm. we all know. So, you know, when that first terrible election night, my knee-jerk reaction was, I'm going to lay low, this thing blows over. I better not do Gaytino anymore, you know? And then when I came out of this shock a couple of days later, I thought, no. This is a time not to retreat, but to really stand up and be louder than ever. And we all have to do that. We all have to do what you've been doing forever. You are literally a national treasure, and I treasure our friendship, and I thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan, and I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing, because you are also a long-distance runner and carrying on the justice work that your dad started through his music and you through your art. And thank you very much for producing the play Gaytino that I have seen twice and love it. And urge everybody, if you haven't seen it, please, now it's time. And I understand that you're working on some other great projects.
Thank you. This is Dan Guerrero with the Gaytino Report, and I've been talking with a true American hero, Dolores Huerta. Until next time, ten orgullo. Be proud.
So there's still time for a last word. And tonight, that's an audio essay from Peter Dell.
Daddy, what does gay mean? My father blushed, a reaction I wasn't used to from a man who nothing can really shock. Except that day when I was 5, the day I asked my father what the word gay meant. I looked at my brother. He was 2.5 years older. He was supposed to know this stuff already. When I looked at him, my eyebrows raised questioningly. He only shrugged. I don't know. I was in the back seat of the VW Beetle, sitting next to the paper bags filled with groceries, as my father began to explain. My brother sat in the front seat next to my dad. You remember how babies are made, right? My father began. We three men had this talk a couple of months before, when my brother asked where babies came from. I loved hearing about the birds and the bees from my dad. It had seemed mysterious and magical, this wonderful chemical reaction in this amazing product called a baby. We remember, my brother said. And you remember that when a man and a woman love each other very much, they have sex and then a baby is created? Sex. Making babies. I wanted to giggle, but I knew adults didn't giggle. Well, sometimes a man and a man love each other very much, or a woman and a woman. And if they love each other enough, they may have sex with each other. That's what being gay is. My brother and I were very quiet, silent, in fact, taking it all in. A man and a man having sex? Or a woman and a woman? It seemed different. Strange, but a strange that could be good. Cliff and Jim, your godfathers, Peter, my dad said, they're gay. I leaned forward so I could hear better. Really? I asked. Yep, my dad said, they've been together almost 10 years now. It made sudden and obvious sense why they lived in the same house. In my mind, the analogy was made. Cliff and Jim were married. Is a lesbian a gay woman? My brother asked. In the back seat, I quietly tried out the word in my mouth. Lesbian. I made another little giggle. Lesbian, lesbian, lesbian. Yes, very good, my dad said, more to Graham than to me. Peter's godmothers, Bess and Judy, are lesbians. So Cliff and Jim and Bess and Judy are all gay? I asked. My godparents were some of my favorite adults. They treated me well and talked to me like an adult. I admired them more than many of my blood relatives. Yes, my dad said. Cliff and Bess were very good friends with me and Mommy when we first met. Then they met Jim and Judy, so now they're all your godparents. That's no fair, Graham said. I only have 2 godparents. Your godparents are very special, my dad said to Graham. Just because you only have 2 doesn't make them any less important. I want gay godparents, my brother muttered so that I could hear, but my dad couldn't. The Beetle pulled into our driveway. We all helped carry the groceries in. My mom met us in the kitchen. How was the trip to the store? She said, to no one in particular. Great, I said. We learned what gay meant. My mom seemed a little surprised, but only nodded her head. Good. Good. We unpacked groceries. Graham and I played catch out in the street. The day went on.
Now I have children of my own. They ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? I tell them tenderly. Hey, said I, whatever will be.
Okay, that's it for tonight. I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, and Rainbow Minute producers, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you are interested in volunteering with IMRU in any capacity, email volunteer@imruradio.org. And a reminder, because we're a global podcast, as well as a show broadcast by the station, you can always hear our weekly show posted to kpfk.org, even during our hiatus from the over-the-air schedule during fun drives. Also catch us at iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts. We close tonight with a song from Seth Sykes that proves Broadway is coming back, but it has been forever changed. Good night.
Seth Sykes wanted very much to stay alive, but Seth Sykes did not like his K95, so Seth Sykes bought himself a mask, a multicolored mask to wear. Seth Sykes' mask was elegant, the cut was fine, the tasteful style was the ultimate in good design, and this is why it caught the eye. A king would stop and stare.
When I got to try it on, I knew my greenish days were gone. Such a dazzling mask of many colors, how I loved my mask of many colors. It was red and yellow and green and brown and blue.
Seth Sykes' mask was cooler than a color wheel. His unmasked face had never been that big a deal. It made him swank, it matched his tank. The people seemed to care.
I look handsome, I look smart, I am a walking work of art. Such a dazzling mask of many colors, how I love my mask of many colors. I feel magic, I feel free, I brighten up the scenery. Such a dazzling mask of many colors, how I love my mask of many colors. It was red and yellow and green and brown and scarlet and black and ochre and peach and ruby and olive and violet and fawn.
I will never take it off,
no one panics when I cough. Such a dazzling mask of many colors, how I love my mask of many colors. It was red and yellow and green and brown and scarlet and black and ochre and peach and ruby and olive and violet and fawn and lilac and gold and chocolate and mauve and cream and crimson and silver and rose and